Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I am your temporary host, Alex Schumacher. Today, we're just going to jump right in with a question of the week.
Can you tell me the funniest moment that you've had with your father or involving a father?
It might have been for Christmas or something. We were all saying our goodbyes, and he goes, just think about it. Next time we get together, it could be for a funeral. The question is whose, you know. But yeah, he always kind of had a little darker sense of humor, a little more tongue-in-cheek.
Would you say that you've kind of inherited that darker sense, or are you a bit brighter?
I'm a combination between him and my mom. My mom has more of a practical, joking sense of humor. My dad is, he's a storyteller. He's got a great memory for details and really can animate a story just from his memory, and he can really tell a good story, and I kind of inherited a little bit of that from him.
We play soccer, and I put his shoes, and he was looking for them, and he couldn't find it. So at the end, he couldn't play because I had them.
Does he like soccer a lot?
Yes.
So maybe that wasn't funny for him, but...
Yeah, but the thing is that I lost mine, so he didn't know that I had them, so...
memory I have my dad doing funny stuff is Halloween, he would always dress up in some scary costume, sit out front of the house and on a tree trunk. And as we walked by, he would pretend he was fake, you know, a statue, and then he would freak us out. That's a good memory I have of my dad. Do you have any funny memory you want to share?
The truffle shuffle.
Well, we watched The Goonies once, and I had to demonstrate to him what the truffle shuffle was before we watched the movie, and so I did, and he thought it was hilarious.
Well, my dad is the epitome of great punchlines and a poker face. And so my husband was going to Sweden, and we're Swedish. And so my dad said, be sure to say hi to the Johnsons for me. And you had, it was like, that was just so typical of my dad. He was great with the punchlines. He'd say, somebody would say, do you want some wine with your meal? And he'd say, no thanks, I'm not driving. Quick-witted and funny and known for his personality, so.
What's the funniest thing that you can tell me that your dad has ever done?
My dad changed his clothes in a public parking lot. We were going to a beach, and he just changed his clothes right there. He put on a swimming suit right there. We were horrified. Being teenagers, no one else seemed to notice. So that's what I've learned now as a parent. Nobody else cares except for your own children.
You know, when I was a kid, he used to dress up as a clown and come to not only all our birthday parties, but he used to go to the 4th of July parade in our city.
Big city or?
No, very small.
So he was a well-known clown.
Yes. Right. The firemen knew him.
This is actually when I was younger. I was a big Barbies fan. I had every Barbie you could ever imagine. And so for Christmas, my parents got me a Barbie tent and a whole like dress-up stuff. And so when it was just my family and I didn't have anyone to play with, but I was really excited to use it. So I made my dad go in to the Barbie tent with me, and I put on like Barbie earrings on him.
So you might have noticed that question of the week was done by one of the show's producers, Emily Allen. And if you're really a longtime listener, you might remember that question of the week from an episode we did for Father's Day almost 2 years ago. So the reason I played that question of the week is because, well, Emily is leaving us. After almost a year and a half as a producer at the podcast, we are having to say goodbye to Emily. I sat down with Emily to talk to her about her involvement at the podcast and her favorite stories that she's done.
Yeah, that was my first question of the week. And I was very awful. I was very afraid to approach people, even though I had all the equipment and I was super official. So I actually got those interviews at Minnehaha Park. I was too afraid to ask anyone on campus in case they'd recognize me. The day before that, though, I tried at Nicollet Mall with all these people in business suits walking around, because I was like, adults, they're not going to care. And nobody would talk to me. I think I asked like 30 people.
Then after all that, you ended up applying and getting hired as a producer. Do you want to talk about that process and kind of your foray into being an official staff member for the podcast?
We had a couple of people just kind of quit because, you know, they were had other commitments and things. So there were two spots open. I mean, I was too afraid to apply because there were a couple other people that I was just like, oh, you know, they're more ambitious about radio than I am. Maybe I shouldn't. But I did, and I got it. And I remember during the interview process, so it was the editor, Patrick, and then another producer named Emily. And she was like, hey, we were actually thinking of going to Standing Rock. And she's like, I mean, you expressed interest in that. Would you be interested in helping out with that if we wanted to pitch it to our programming advisor? And I really just wanted to get hired. So I was like, yeah, I'm ambitious. I would love to go to the middle of nowhere in North Dakota and just report, you know. And I just kind of said it because I was like, they're not going to let us go anyways. So that night I got a phone call. I'd been hired along with Jaka. They called me and they're like, congrats about the job. Oh, by the way, we sent an email. We're going to Standing Rock. And I was like, oh, oh. But it was actually a really cool trip. You know, I didn't originally want to go. I was a little scared. But then when I came back, I actually ended up hosting the episode. So that was the first thing I had ever reported as a producer and the first episode I'd ever hosted.
The Dakota Access Pipeline, a $3.7 billion investment, will carry approximately 470,000 barrels of oil daily from the North Dakota Bakken region in the northwest corner of the state to Patoka, Illinois. At 1,172 miles in length, it will cross 50 counties and four states. And according to its builder, Energy Transfer Partners, the pipeline is scheduled to be finished by the end of 2016. The pipeline isn't even finished yet, and it already has a history. After a route was proposed and rejected in 2014 to cross the Missouri River north of Bismarck, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers approved a route that would allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross the Missouri River north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. There has been a lot of debate as to whether or not the Army Corps officially communicated with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. And now, many are protesting the pipeline's construction because the current route will interrupt culturally significant grave sites, and it could also pose as a threat to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe's water. Energy Transfer Partners said the pipeline will generate over 8,000 local jobs, it will bring in millions of dollars locally, and it will increase our energy independence from other nations. But how much does this really mean when so many people are worried for the well-being of the Standing Rock Sioux? Last weekend, three reporters from Radio K's Real College podcast took a road trip to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in Fort Yates, North Dakota.
So I kind of just put the idea out there because I had pet chickens at home in Wisconsin, where my parents live in Wisconsin. I had just pitched, you know, I want to do a story on chickens, and I wasn't going to do it. But then I found a woman, you know, her and her husband run a chicken rescue out in like this rural suburb. I couldn't even remember where, but it's off of Minneapolis. I mean, it was like a 40-minute drive away, and I actually convinced our editor at the time, Patrick, to drive me because I didn't have my license until like a couple months ago. It was more than just a quirky story in the end about like chickens. It was somebody who really cared about this one issue and was doing something about it. And I thought that was really cool. Also, I mean, the chickens were cute.
Back in 2000, before the fad began, when I found that they were routinely picking up stray birds or seizing them for neglect and abuse, and I realized that there were no organizations, there was no one there for those animals.
I remember when I was first
That's Mary Britton Klaus, co-founder of Chicken Run Rescue. When I first met Mary for our interview, I also got to meet Hershey, the chick nestled cozily in a fleece sling wrapped around Mary's neck.
I had to put the scarf on. She decided she was really interested in a freckle on my neck.
Hershey, now 8 weeks old, was born in a hatchery.
They were careless in controlling the temperature while the eggs were incubating. She was born deformed. Her legs, they're angled upward. She can't stand. She can't walk. She can kind of roll around. She goes surprisingly fast on a slippery floor.
Hershey's story is just one of many when it comes to the Rescue Chickens of Chicken Run Rescue, a local nonprofit organization founded in 2001 to provide Twin Cities rescue chickens with food, shelter, and care.
The individual bird is the whole premise. It's the whole concept behind Chicken Run Rescue. for us, it's this bird. This individual bird right in front of us, and they have a unique personality. They have a history.
Part of this focus on the individual chicken entails naming the birds.
And it's really hard to name the birds sometimes, especially if we got a large group of people, chickens at one time. Oftentimes we will name the birds after the person who brought them to safety.
I was impressed that Mary could point to any given chicken and provide me with a detailed history and a name without any hesitation. I was even more impressed, though, that she could recognize some of the birds by sound. Every time a rooster interrupted our interview, she was able to name it.
And so when we... Yes, I know that's Beard. That was Beardsley.
Aside from viewing chickens as individuals, Chicken Wren Rescue also emphasizes the point that these animals are companions.
All of the birds live under the same roof with us. That's part of the philosophy here at Chicken Run, is that you wouldn't do that to your dog or your cat, and these are all companion animals, so everyone sleeps under the same roof.
And indeed, all of the chickens live in the home. On a tour of the house, I was shown a boys' room and a girls' room downstairs, to which roosters and hens retreat to for the night. Each bird has its own carrier with comfy, shredded newspaper bedding, and the rooms are kept pretty clean, too. Upstairs was my favorite part, and what looked like a bookcase or a TV stand upon first glance is actually a mini apartment for the special needs birds that Chicken Run Rescue also takes in. One of the compartments I noticed had tiny sweaters on hangers, much like something you'd see in a dollhouse. These sweaters were for Linaris, a bird with a bacterial dermatitis that has caused her to lose all of her feathers. Even with their hard pasts, there's no denying these birds have a pretty sweet deal now. They live in a home, literally in a home, with individualized 24/7 care. Unfortunately, Chicken Run Rescue can't offer this to every bird someone brings by.
It's getting close to exceeding the human-to-bird ratio that we want to maintain. It's such a temptation in rescue work. It's so hard to say no. But it's really basic math. For every additional animal that you take responsibility for, it's proportionately less attention that the rest of the birds will get.
When the organization was first starting out, Mary said she and her husband / co-founder, Bert, were keeping the chickens in their North Minneapolis home. Since then, Mary, Bert, and the rest of the organization have relocated to a property with much more land so they can accommodate a few extra chickens. However, the organization still receives plenty of calls from people who can no longer handle their backyard chickens.
People's circumstances change. And what are you going to do with the birds? So, I mean, there's a lot of things that people who are considering getting them, just from the practical standpoint of this animal's going to live a long time, and they're going to require care and food and vet bills, and what are you going to do if, Junior goes to college and doesn't want to take care of them anymore? So, family circumstances change all the time, and sadly, the birds are pretty low on the priority list when a family is in upheaval, so that's... oftentimes that's how birds come to us, too.
When Chicken Run Rescue is unable to take in a bird, they still go to great lengths to make sure that bird has a place to go.
Oftentimes, if people find a chicken and contact us, we have set them up with everything that they need to care for the bird and teach them everything that they need to know. They can come here, they can volunteer and learn. And we always encourage them just simply to take responsibility for the bird that they have rescued.
So maybe I wasn't ready to take a chicken home after our interview, but I definitely couldn't object to this last request from Mary.
The house rule is that everyone who visits has to hold a chicken close to their heart and let us take a picture.
Is there a recommended chicken I hold?
Want to learn more about Chicken Run Rescue? The organization's website is www.chickenrunrescue.org. They also have a Facebook page, where you can learn more about some of the chickens I got to meet for this story. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Allen. They're a half coffee shop and also like a leather shop for like all sorts of different kinks. So at first I thought it was just a really cool episode, like, oh, they're half this and, you know, there's this cool twist and it's not just walking into a coffee shop. It's walking into like a sex kink shop. And then, you know, I went to interview them and they were also like another group of people that were super passionate about this, like an issue, acceptance of things.
We originally opened in December of 2012. We were at a different location. And it was in the basement of a mansion near Loring Park, actually. So we had to close due to a zoning issue, but we decided, let's see if we can take the energy of everything we've done in the last 6 months, because we found that we would have clients, you know, they would want to stick around and just hang out and be part of the community. And it was like, how do we take that energy and make it into something bigger and better?
That's Tynan Fox, co-owner for Twin Cities Leather and Latte.
The next since 2012, they've been selling kink and BDSM-related leather goods. Twin Cities,
but they do
leather
a little bit
latte,
more than just sell. They actually make their leather harnesses. They repair and tailor leather goods for clients. And they offer a community for people of all kinks. Also, they sell coffee.
It gives people an opportunity to feel like they are being themselves when they're not at a bar, you know? It's kind of hard, I guess, for some kinky people to be able to reconcile their kink or their fetish or who they are as a person without necessarily being around a bar late at night. And we're kind of bringing leather into the light, I guess, is a good way to think about it.
Twin Cities Leather and Latte is a small business located on Hennepin Avenue in a two-story building that looks a little bit like a house. Downstairs is the coffee shop and where they sell the leather. Upstairs is the workshop where they design and make the harnesses. The team at Twin Cities Leather and Latte is small, but they're dedicated.
We have always said, and we've never shied away from the idea that we are a kinky business. We're owned by kinky people, and we're here for kinky people. There's myself and my business partner, Carrie, that I was talking about. We are the two owners, and then we have a staff of five baristas that all work for us at the counter and sell things on the sales floor. And Kurt is actually working right now. He's one of the one of our staff members that helps out on the workbench upstairs as well.
Here's Kurt talking about staff responsibilities.
So being a barista here is kind of a multifaceted job because you do have multiple responsibilities. So, I mean, we are leather and latte. So, yes, the majority of our customers will come in and have the typical coffee shop experience with the atmosphere that I'm sure Tynan kind of expanded on. But we also do take care of the leather here in the back. So when customers will come in for a fitting, all of our leather work is entirely custom. So as a barista, you do take care of fittings like that, entering in orders and making sure that customers get exactly what they want and they have a great experience.
After sitting in the coffee shop area to talk with Tynan, we moved on to check out the leather products, including the harnesses they make in the store.
These are just some of our harnesses we make. Like, we make all of these from scratch. We buy leather hides from various retailers, and I mean, we cut them up, glue them, stitch them, punch holes and set snaps and rivets into all of them. So these are all made with our own two hands. There's very few of them that leave the store without having been touched by one of us.
I see these teddy bear designs, bicycle designs. How do you choose the fabric? Is there a reason for specific types?
Yes, these are actually what we call the ABDL harnesses. That stands for adult baby / diaper lover. This is one of the newest designs in our collection. It's one of the many examples of how we really reach out to people, no matter what their kink or fetish is. It's not really just confined to leather, because we realize that you didn't choose your kink or your fetish. For many people out there, especially myself, whatever your fetish is, it's been with you since the beginning of time, and nothing you do is ever going to change that.
Upstairs, I got to see the workspace where the harnesses are made. There's a couch on one end of the room where Tynan says staff can take a break, but the space is mostly occupied by leather hides, hanging from the wall, draped on the tables, spread out on the floor. You can hear Carrie, the designer, working with the leather while Tynan talks about the space.
But this is where all the magic happens. As you can see, we kind of take a little bit of a... We have a spot where we can rest, but this is mostly our workstation and backstock, really, and storage. We have just the one sewing machine. Carrie does the vast majority of the sewing. And obviously, like I said, all of the design, I just kind of help out when I'm told to.
Twin Cities Leather and Latte is at 2717 Hennepin Avenue in Minneapolis. They also have a website.
Don't forget you can shop online at twincitiesleather.com.
Does that include coffee too, or just leather?
Just leather. It's kind of hard to run an online cafe.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Allen. When Molly and Heidi invited me to their offices in the back of Boneshaker Books, I thought I was walking into two extra storage rooms.
So we have, you know, our fiction is extensive. We've got
the
general fiction.
The shelves were overflowing
mystery,
with just
romance,
books.
Mystery, romance, paranormal, romance, urban fiction. And then we have...
The books in the offices are different from the other books at Boneshaker because they're not for sale. These books are donations to the Women's Prison Book Project, which Molly and Heidi are volunteers for.
We're one of the only two organizations in the country that send books exclusively to women and trans people who are incarcerated around the country. We actually split the country with the other organization, which is the Chicago Books to Women in Prison Project.
That's Molly Berg, one of the co-captains I met Sunday, who explained to me the process of how the organization receives requests for books and then sends them.
If you want to see one of the letters, I can do that.
It all starts with a letter from a woman or a trans person requesting a book.
And this
is from the women's prison.
One of your more recent stories.
So, for instance, the first thing we'll do is we'll take the letter and we see where is she staying right now. So she's at Gatesville.
That's Gatesville in Texas.
And the next thing we do is
the Women's Prison Book Project has a list of prisons they know receive books.
So we'll take a look at the prison restrictions for Gatesville, which is extensive. No, obviously, queer books. That's a fun one.
No Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, right. And then they have specific ones. No Color Purple. No Bluest Eye. So, you know.
The Gatesville woman in this letter didn't ask for anything openly queer or a copy of Silence of the Lambs. All she wanted was a journal.
Okay, so this is really interesting request. Nowhere in Texas can receive journals, because they sell journals in their commissary, and so they don't want us sending them out for free. So unfortunately, what we have to do is we have a little page printed up that says, we're really sorry, we can't send journals to people in Texas. We hope that you appreciate these books that we picked out for you.
The Women's Prison Book Project has a lot of letters printed out for scenarios like the one you just heard. They have a letter that they send with books asking recipients to share the books with other inmates. They have a letter for inmates in facilities that don't accept books, with a list of recommendations from the Women's Prison Book Project. And if you're a cisgendered male requesting a book, expect this.
Then we send you a little letter that we call the man letter that tells you where you can request books. So we don't send to male-identified male prisoners in male prisons.
Along with all the letters they send, the Women's Prison Book Project also gets a fair amount of letters back. Molly showed me a huge binder with thank you notes.
So we save a lot of the letters that we get back from people in prison, and we share them with our supporters and with each other. But the other things that we save them for, too, are so people really get an idea of what life is like for people.
One letter Molly showed me was from an inmate in New Mexico.
So, for instance, thank you for the books. I really loved them. They really made me smile. And then went into, it was a brilliant choice. I laughed so hard. I'm seeing the authors of previous books you've sent, and I'd like to read them.
Same the letter goes on here. To talk about some of the wildfires spreading across New Mexico, and her prison's plan to relocate her and other inmates.
Oh, here we go. Several COs here are also a part of the National Guard and have helped fight the fires. They just signed the contract for us female inmates, but we still won't be moving for another few months.
Working for the Women's Prison Book Project has taught its volunteers a lot about life in prison for women and transgender people across the country. Molly says there's a lot to be learned from the restrictions alone. For example, the Women's Prison Book Project is located in Boneshaker Books, because some prisons will only accept books if they're coming from a bookstore. Heidi Heisey, another volunteer, said the organization also has to send receipts, so inmates can prove the books are theirs to prison officials.
Staff at prisons would come into people's area or room or whatever it is, and if there was no way for that person to prove that they owned the books that were on their bookshelf or on their nightstand, the prison would just take them and be like, you can't prove these are yours.
You get a little bit of a deeper look into how people are feeling when they're incarcerated. And it's definitely, it's humanizing if you didn't already think so. Yeah, we're getting out of the realm of things that I can speak authoritatively about. I mean, I'm not all that philosophical a person, but you pick things up when you work here for sure. I mean, just reading the restrictions list gives you a much better idea of what life is actually like for people in prison than you would have if you've never seen that the fact that they can't even read the color purple in prison. So there's that.
The Women's Prison Book Project is located at Boneshaker Books on 23rd Ave in Minneapolis. Volunteers meet Sundays from noon to 3 to sort books, pick books, check books, and mail books. If you have paperback books to send, you can bring them to Boneshaker Books. For especially big deliveries, you should email the group beforehand at womensprisonbookprojects@gmail.com. Heidi says they especially need things like urban fiction, true crime, GED study books, and how-to guides for things like crochet. The organization also accepts money to pay for things like postage and shipping materials. They have to buy all their own tape and envelopes. For more information, you can check out the group's Facebook page. It's just Women's Prison Book Project, or you can look at their website, wpbp.org.
I'd like to thank Emily for sitting down and talking with me. I think I can safely say on behalf of Jaka and Liv and all of our volunteers, thank you, Emily, for everything you've done for the podcast. And podcast listeners, if you're worried about how you're going to get your weekly fix of Emily Allen, fear not. You can catch her every morning during the week as one of the hosts of Rock and Roll Over here at Radio K. And as always, Real College Podcast's host and managing editor is Jaka Maldonado Medina. The podcast is produced by me, Liv Riggins, and for one final time, Emily Allen. If you like us, be sure to subscribe on iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. You can catch new episodes every Monday at 6:30 here on Radio K, or we upload them to our website, radiok.org. See you all next week.